Hey everybody, welcome to the 35th episode of the JDO Show. I am your host, J. David Osborne, aka Veneto Beauty Friends. And today on the podcast, I have Mr. Rob Hart. He is the author of several books in the Ash McKenna series. He also writes books with Mr. James Patterson, who's a writer. He did some books that are crime-ish, I think. Rob had come on Facebook and he put up his 10 unpopular posts and I really liked him, so we kind of go through those one by one. Before we get to the podcast, I have my fucking dog. I'm sitting on my dog because where I sit on the bed to record this thing, she was laying there, and as she's gotten progressively older, she's gotten more and more stubborn, and so she just is kind of refusing to move. So I'm kind of sitting on my dog, which is a weird sensation. I think she likes it. I just fucking lay on her and, you know, hug her, and she's like, this is cool. This is where I'm going to sleep. I recently started back up the old freelance biz. I've been doing that for, 4 years or something. Basically, there's a website called jdoedits.wordpress.com. It's very professional. It's a WordPress blog that I put a ton of effort and stuff into. It took me like at least 15 minutes to set this shit up. I think the problem with it in the past has been that I've charged too much, because you go online and you see people charge anywhere from like a cent a word to 2 cents a word. But those are like these big companies that kind of farm out this work to workers and stuff. And, you know, I mean, I realized at a certain point, it's like, I know that I don't have a shitload of money. And I think that a lot of people who, you know, kind of run in the same circles as me are sort of in the same position. So if you want your book fucking edited, I can do that. And I just like fucking cut the price in half. So, you know, I mean, I put out about 30 books on Broken River, and I've edited about 75 novels over the past 4 years or so, of all different kinds, everything from, you know, Christian memoirs to literary novels to sci-fi to horror. I'll probably put up some, like, testimonials or something soon. Yeah, no, so that's up there, and like I said, I cut the price in half because I figured, you know, why not? I mean, it's still good work, you know, if I could get, I'd rather just, you know, work with people and fucking, you know, get these books set up, maybe get a little bit of more work out of it, because the way it was going before, it would be a nice, like, chunk of change, but, I mean, it's just not very many people could fucking afford it, which I get, because the economy sucks balls, and it's just kind of difficult to get that done. Anyway, I'm going to stop rambling, but yeah, if you're interested in getting your book all fucking fixed up and getting another pair of eyes on it and getting it, you know, ready to be, whether it's self-published or sent out to agents for queries or whatever, just go to jdoedits.wordpress.com or just straight up email me at jdavidosborne@gmail.com and we'll figure something out, because this year I'm going hard, folks. I'm going fucking hard. The past 2 years I've just been fucking a little asshole, just sitting on my fucking laurels, like lamenting the fact that things aren't fucking given to me. And I'm like, oh yeah, wait, I forgot. You actually have to work for shit. That's what you have to fucking do. So I'm done with that kind of shit. Every day I have like a specific goal that I need to hit, because, you know, like getting Broken River rolling again, I mean, everything is such like small stakes that it won't be that hard to just like get everything like firing on all cylinders again. It's just a matter of, you know, when you don't make a shitload of money, even like being a little bit in the hole kind of sucks. So my whole thing is to just like kind of build that up, and through building that up, I can kind of get Broken River cranking again. We're going to have Chupacabra Vengeance by David Bowles. It's going to be the first one up, and that's going to happen next year, because it's just going to fucking go, dude. I mean, I was waiting for, I don't know, like a perfect time to do this shit, and there is no perfect time. Like, I just have to fucking do it and, you know, build it back up as it goes. So anyway, that's enough rambling from me. Rob Hart, he's a really smart guy. He knows a lot about the publishing industry, so there's some good shop talk in here if that kind of thing interests you. And we also just cut up and act like just our regular asshole selves. So please do enjoy this interview with Mr. Rob Hart. Hey, Rob, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you're having a few drinks there?
Well, I already had a few drinks, so now I'm having another one,
Right. Which is,
because
it's kind of what you do, right? Like,
yeah, I had time to sober up, so I thought maybe I should get back to it.
right on, right on. See, my problem and why I do my best to not drink as much as possible is because once I get to beer number two, it's never, I had three beers. It's, you hit two and then it's six, seven, something like that. So.
I've cut way back on my drinking. Like, I'm rarely drinking these days, but I was at a holiday party tonight, and I had a couple because they were pouring like vats of whiskey,
Right on.
and I, as I was coming home and you suggested that we move this to tonight, I was like, well, fuck it, I'll just drink some more because that'll ensure that I'll say something
It's like I gotta have enough,
entertaining.
like a certain amount of alcohol to talk to David.
Essentially, yeah. I got to work up to it.
No, I feel you, man. I feel you. So,
No,
well,
man, I'm happy to hear from you. I miss you.
I know, man. I miss you too. I wasn't able to make it out to BoucherCon, so I missed everybody there.
Yeah.
Because yeah, I was just like trying to save as much money as possible and, cut back on my con experience. But I'll be in your neighborhood here in about a month or so. So.
Yeah, I got a surprise for you. I got something really fun we're going to do. I think you're really going to dig it.
Oh, I love it. I love it. See, I think I treated you to the strip club last time. So,
You did.
yeah.
Here's what I'm going to tell you. Wear comfortable shoes
Okay.
and be ready to like set aside like up to 3 hours.
Okay, yeah,
But
I can do that.
it's going to be worth it.
All right. That sounds cool. So the first thing that I wanted to talk about, man, because you agreed to be on the podcast a few days ago before this happened. But then yesterday at well, I guess it was probably in the morning your time. It says 5:43 a.m. my time. But on Facebook, you made an unpopular opinion post.
Well,
And go ahead.
it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I actually put it together and sat on it for a day before I put it up because I was like, I don't want to just like needlessly like troll or piss people off, but I don't know. I mean, most people seem to respond to it positively.
What made you decide to finally say fuck it and pull the trigger on it?
Well, whenever I see a meme like that, like some sort of like make a list meme on Facebook, my first reaction is how do I do this in a way that's like actually interesting? Because everyone's like unpopular opinion posts were just about
Racism
like,
is bad. It's like, yeah, I
yeah,
know. Yeah.
or it's like the Beatles suck. A lot of people said that the Beatles suck. I feel differently about a lot of people right now, but it's all like movies and music and shit. And I'm like, well, let me do one about publishing because that's actually kind of interesting. And it was just a couple of things that I had been thinking about in a general sense lately, and I put them together and I looked at it and I was like, eh, fuck it, I'll put it up.
For the listeners, could you please give a quick background of yourself in publishing, just so that they know you're not talking out of your ass?
To be clear, I kind of am talking out of my
Well,
ass.
sure. I mean, yeah, but.
I have three novels out. I have been working for Mysterious Press for 6 years. I started working on the website, and now I'm the publisher, and I also run the online workshop program at Lit Reactor. So everything I do is at least tangentially related to publishing.
Yeah. So it's kind of, I mean, talking out your ass or not, I mean, these are opinions that have a kind of grounding in experience, I guess is what I was saying.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go through these here
All right.
and we can, because it's good stuff, man. And I think that this will translate really well as far like in a conversation. So the first one here is big publishers do publish good books. And the reason they won't publish yours is because it's not up to their standards, or it doesn't fit their editorial vision, or sounds like the same book that's been published dozens of times already. Or maybe it's just not good.
Yes.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack here. My first thought when I saw this was, I mean, they do publish good books, but they also publish bad books, of course,
Yeah.
but my thought process was, what seems to be missing here is that I think a lot of publishers also make decisions based on money, right? Like on
Oh,
how
yeah.
much money they think they could make.
Yeah, and to be clear, with all of this stuff, there's a lot of nuance that's kind of hard to get into. But the driving force at that point was I think that a lot of people sort of build this narrative that when their book gets rejected, it's because the big publishers just don't want something difficult, or they don't want something gritty, or they don't want something dark. And so they're putting that blame somewhere else, versus what I think some people need to do is sit down with their work and say, was this the best book that I could have written? Like, from a craft perspective, did I push myself? Did I do something different? Did I really bring it? Or is this book not up to that standard? Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of, you know, I don't want to, it's weird. I mean, you're right. Some publishers just, they aren't interested in challenging things because challenging things are hard to sell. Mm-hmm. But within the past year, I mean, I read Underground Airlines by Ben Winters, which, you know, posits a world in which slavery is still legal in 4 states. Mm-hmm. And it gets pretty dark. And it's a challenging book. And they published it. Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead was a very challenging book. You know, there's a lot of books that we can sit here and name that came out from big publishers that were really big and really good and really popular. So to just sort of make this blanket statement that all the big publishers are just full of shit, that's not really true.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that what I've seen, even with my own experience with rejecting people in general, is that I think the thrust of a lot of these kind of points that you make are encouraging people to take personal responsibility for their career, essentially. And that's what I like, I think, the most about this first point. I like the, or maybe it's just not good thing. Because that's never the thing that comes to people's minds.
Yeah.
You know? It's this or that, or, you know, David's an asshole or Rob's an asshole. But it's never like, well, I mean, maybe you didn't write a good book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had a big come to Jesus moment, like, probably like 6 months ago, where I, you know, my first book, New York, came out from Polis, which is sort of like they're an indie press, but they do some really cool stuff, and I'm really happy. And I'm very happy with how the book was published. But when we were on submission, it went to like every big house, and every big house read it and rejected it. And for a long time, I was like, well, fuck them. They didn't want my book because it was too dark for them. And then what a bunch of assholes. And I came to this point where I'm like, no, you know what? The problem was me. It was not a book that was right for a big publisher. It was better off at a smaller publisher where I can kind of do my own thing, and they can encourage me, and I can learn my craft. And I'm immensely proud of the book, and I'm happy that it was published. I have no regrets. But looking back on it, I can see that that's the level I was writing at. Mm-hmm. So now it's like, well, how do I get to the next level? How do I push myself to the next level? And I feel like sometimes that's a question that people aren't asking themselves. It's sort of just like, well, fuck everyone because they didn't want me. So, you know, that's on them, not on me.
What you said that I think is so important is that there are different levels of publishing for different books. And
yeah,
I mean, you're absolutely correct that big challenging books come out on big presses. I mean, one of my favorites of the past few years was 300 Million by Blake Butler. And that was a Harper Perennial book, right?
Yeah.
Which, holy shit, I don't even know very many small presses that would have, you know, taken a risk on that book. But the thing is that even if you don't want to look at it in terms of either good or bad, I do think that the kind of book that you've written has to be very specific. I mean, it's like think about it like music, you know. If you make a hip hop album, you're not going to sell it to a country music label. You know, and if you make underground avant-garde noise music, you're not going to sell that to Sub Pop Records, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, even specifically, like, so for you, like, you publish Broken River Books. So if you read a book that you love and you think is great, and it's such a good book, but it's just not a Broken River book, you're not compelled. Yeah, you're not compelled to publish it, are you? Like,
no.
Just because it's good. I mean, that's great that it's good, and it sucks to pass on a good book. But if it doesn't fit the worlds that you want it to build, then it shouldn't just be okay. Good is good enough. There's it's like being in love. You know, I mean, it's there or it's not there, and you can't force it if it's not there.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's funny is that there are actually there are books that I actually subjectively enjoyed better than some of the ones that I published, but they didn't fit, right?
You know,
if it's a really incredibly crafted, there was one that I got that was legitimately a fucking romance book. I really liked it. Like, it sucked me in from the first page. I read the whole thing. And, you know, it was maybe one of my favorite things that I read that year, but I, you know, Broken River can't publish that. So yeah, there was nothing I could do. And it sucked to say no, but there are more, I think. No, that's a lie. Not more. But I would say about a quarter of the books that I reject, I actually really, really enjoyed. But if I accepted all of them, I would be publishing 55 books a year, which is...
Exactly.
It's just not feasible, man.
Yeah.
And Broken River would also have no identity, and then nothing would happen. So let's move on to point two here.
Got it.
James Patterson and Stephanie Meyer clearly understand things about the world you don't. What are those things, Rob?
I have no idea. If I knew those things, then I would be selling hundreds of millions of books too. Mm. You know, again, it's one of those things where people sort of measure themselves in such a way that they kind of skew towards anger and hatred. It's like, oh, well, you know, fuck these people. They're ruining literature because my book can't get published. And it's like, well, you know what? Maybe just instead of getting so worked up about it, just concentrate on what you're doing. And again, you know, make sure the craft is there, make sure you're putting in the time, and worry less about what someone else is doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you want to, how's your experience been working on that James Patterson book?
It was really, really good, man. I mean, it was, you know, and I kind of anticipated this was going to come up. So there was one example that I thought of, which I learned something really, really, really good from Patterson. And it's one of those things that kind of like reframed how I think about my own writing.
Okay.
So you're doing these things. It's 30,000 words, the book shots, and you do them in 10,000 word increments. So I did the first 10,000 words and I was really happy with it. I was like, yeah, I totally nailed this. And I sent it in and he was like, this is not working. And I'm like, fuck. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I had to, in one weekend, like tear the whole thing down and redo it. And when you first hear that, when you hear like this isn't working, it sucks because, you know, especially when you feel like you did a good job, mm-hmm. it's not a good feeling. So but I went through the points and I was like, okay, no, this is all correct. These are all mistakes I made. These are all things I could have done better.
Can you give kind of vague, I mean, I know you don't probably want to give the book away, but kind of maybe vague examples of what those mistakes were?
Yeah, well, actually, one of my favorite examples was there was one point in the first chapter where this dude kind of, he attacks another guy and kind of launches himself into him. And I described it as, you know, and he hit him like a cannonball. And Patterson's comment was, you know, nobody knows what it feels like to get hit by a cannonball. You know, when you make these analogies, they have to be things that people can relate to. Oh, and I'm like, fuck, man. Yeah, like, that's a really good point.
That is a good point. Fuck, man.
Yeah, so I learned something. You know, I also was falling into this habit, you know, because they're very short chapters, and I was trying to end every chapter on a little bit of a kicker, like a little dramatic moment that would make you want to move into the next chapter. But I was sacrificing forward momentum in the chapters themselves for that. So it was like it was kind of like structural things and a few character things. And but yeah, I mean, all the stuff that I got back is stuff that I'm now applying to my own writing, and I feel like I'm better off for it.
Cool. So overall, it's just been a good experience.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and the timing couldn't work out better because my fourth book is coming out in July, and the Patterson book is coming out in June. So I can kind of, hopefully there's going to be a little cross promotion. And, you know, I know at least one author who published a book shot with Patterson, and he's going to be doing some more of them. And he's already seeing, like, people are like, oh, I really like this. So I went back and I picked up the books that you wrote under your own name. So, you know, that's not such a bad thing.
No, not at all. How is that fast release schedule going?
For
it is
my
fast,
books,
dude. I mean, like, New York came out, like, what, a fucking year ago?
Something like that.
June
2015.
Like,
yeah.
Christ, man.
Well, so my publisher, Jason Pinter, his plan was if we publish the books quickly, it would build shelf space. And so if I had, like, two books already on a shelf and the third one came out, a bookstore might be less likely to send back the first two. So he's just a smart guy in general, so I'll just sort of trust his instincts. Mm-hmm. But it's been good. I mean, I feel really happy with the quality of the books, and I got no complaints. I mean, it's been hard kind of keeping up with that, but we're also slowing down a bit now. Like, there's going to be a gap between the third and the fourth book. And then I think the fifth book is probably going to come out like a year after the fourth, and then the series will be done. So
I feel like that's a really good strategy, and it's one that I've tried to implement in almost everything I do. When this podcast first came out, I recorded, I think, 25 episodes in like 2 weeks, and I just dumped them all online. And the reason for that was exactly what you're talking about, like basically shelf space, right? Like, yeah. I wanted people to be able to go back and like kind of listen to 25 hours of audio and make a decision. And Broken River was similar to that, dude. I mean, like, we came out with, you know, almost 30 books in 2 years. Then it's been quiet for a little bit, but, you know, it's going to slow way, way down. But you want to build that up so that you have a back catalog, basically.
Yeah, I mean, the important thing is that you can keep the quality up. And I don't feel like I sacrificed anything. So, I mean, I definitely a couple of times approached a dangerous level of burnout, but so far have managed to avoid, you know, running into a wall until I knocked myself unconscious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you should not design your cover. Your friend should not design your cover. A graphic designer with a lot of experience designing covers should design your cover. That is a pretty much 100% agreement right there. I couldn't think of anything else to say about that. So many covers in the small press world are just fucking real bad.
I also think like the author is the worst person to ask about the cover, because I feel like the cover is very important in a collaborative sense, in that you need an outside set of eyes. You need someone who is divorced from the work in order to interpret it in a way that's going to be a little bit more attractive or attention grabbing. Because, I mean, all authors kind of – I think all authors have a general sense of, you know, what they want on their cover, what their cover might look like, and it might not be the best idea. Like, mm-hmm. It's really good. It's the same reason you want someone else to edit your work, you know, eventually, because you need that outside set of eyes.
Right. And, that's definitely – it's a problem that I've run into with Broken River, where I suddenly discovered that asking the author what they wanted was the worst thing that I could possibly do. And I really don't do it anymore. And I made the mistake recently with a first-time author of asking them what they thought of this cover, and they came back with, you know, two very long Facebook pages full of notes, or Facebook messages rather, full of notes. And I'm just like, I can't work with this. This isn't how covers work, dude.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's supposed to sell the book, not like express who you are as a human being. But let's see, moving on. Most small publishers are really cool and important, and I read many small press books, but some of them are just self-publishing you by proxy. What does that mean?
I think that because I know some people who have published with a small press or like a really, really small press, and then they're shocked that they didn't get any trade reviews, that they didn't get any bookstore placement, that they didn't sell, you know, 1,000 copies in the first week. And there seems to be this sort of problem with expectations where, you know, you have a publisher that's like, oh yeah, no, we're just like the big guys. It's going to be cool. But they don't have the contacts, they don't have the muscle, they don't have the feet on the ground to kind of get a lot of this stuff done. You know, this one, I kind of wish I had expanded on a little bit. I mean, I love small presses, and you had referred to that before. You know, there are plenty of presses that are great homes for books. You know, like, right. Not every book has to be with a big publisher. Some books are perfect for smaller publishers. I think smaller publishers are very good in the sense that they've given an avenue to writers who wouldn't necessarily be able to reach readers otherwise. You know, I mean, Broken River does awesome fucking stuff. Well, yeah, and you know, I would be a fan of you guys if we weren't buddies, but you know, you do nice books and you get really, really nice attention for them, and it's, you know, it's a punk rock operation. But
oh, totally. Yeah. No money.
Yeah, but you know, you've gotten some coverage in some really nice places. I mean, fucking Gabino in the LA Review of Books.
That was a big one. That was a big coup, man.
That's fucking awesome, and especially because Gabino's such a good dude. It's so good to see.
You know what's funny? If since kind of the theme of this so far has been sort of writing industry advice, being a good dude goes a long fucking way.
Oh, yeah.
I think people don't get that. Not being a dick, doing favors for – you know, as a crime writer, as a couple of crime writers actually, you know, there's a common sort of theme in crime fiction where – you know, when you move into a certain territory, you have to do favors for the local boss and things like that, you know, just to get in good. That's kind of, I think, every business ever. right?
Yeah.
Except in this business, it's not necessarily, you know, putting someone's head in a toilet. It's more just like doing a favor, making a connection between two people who didn't know each other before, you know, just kind of, it serves a twofold purpose. One, being a good person is just good, which is tautological, but needs to be said. But two, I mean, Gabino built up a lot of favors in a sense by just being a really good guy to everybody for years and years and years, you know?
Well, I think that he, I think he's the one who first said this to me. It's called being a good literary citizen, which I totally agree with, because there's, you know, look, books are a hard fucking business. It's hard to get people to read. And a lot of what you're relying on is word of mouth. A lot of books that people read are books that someone else told them to read. It's not because you saw a fucking tweet, or it's not because you saw, you know, someone's clever post on Facebook. It's because someone that you know and trust said, hey, I read this book and it was really good and you should read it too.
Yep.
And so it makes a difference when people are out there supporting each other. And that's great. And yeah, Gabino is just, I don't know how that dude reads as much as he does. I mean, I struggle just to keep up with the small pile I have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he's got a natural love for it. I also think he's probably just a really fast reader. I'm a slow reader, surprisingly, man. I don't remember how slow I am exactly. I think I'm like 600 words a minute or something.
But
I think most people are up around 800 or 900. So, and then really fast readers can do, you know, 1,000 or something like that. And so, I mean, if you can read fast and comprehend it, then I mean, it totally makes sense to me that you can knock out 2 or 3 books a day, which is what he seems to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But okay, so let's see. Did we totally cover that one? I think we did, right?
Yeah, for the most part, I think ultimately what it comes down to is just having realistic expectations and knowing that, like, you know, it's awesome to be with a small press. It's awesome that someone is putting their faith in you. But, you know, not to expect, there's certain things you just shouldn't expect to happen.
Mm-hmm. Some of publishing is luck. A lot more is hard work and talent. Luck is not the only deciding factor in success. And if you think it is, maybe you need to examine why you think that. That's really interesting to me. And I think it echoes a lot of what's come before, right?
Well, you know, that one I actually feel is a little bit catty, because I know a couple of authors who you know, they've reached a point in their career where it's just like, you know, talent has nothing to do with this because I'm such a good writer, and it's like, it's just luck. That's all it is. And it's like, no, dude, like, you know, I'm where I am because I worked my fucking ass off. I mean, yes, I've been lucky. But I have put in so many fucking hours and so much fucking time. I mean, sometimes to the detriment of my health, sometimes to the detriment of my relationship with my wife. And I always try to find a balance to make sure that's not the case. But sometimes it happens and it's right. Fucking hard.
Right.
But you do the work. And so to say that it's just luck diminishes that, which annoys me.
It's kind of a slap in the face, right?
Yeah.
Well, and I think that the other important thing to think about here is that, let's say hypothetically it is luck, the thing that gets you from the realm of unlucky to the realm of lucky is hard work. Lucky people tend to be lucky for a reason. It's not something just fucking falls out of the sky, you know.
Yeah.
It is totally luck. I mean, you know, when you look at anybody who's had any number of success, it's like, well, I ended up, you know, buying a beer for this guy at this thing. And then I saw him on a street 3 days later and he was there with his boss. And then we all got to talking and now I work for, you know, XYZ, right?
Yeah.
But it's the act of buying the beer, right? So
yeah.
With publishing, it's that too. I mean, you just buy as many lottery tickets as you possibly can. And then, hey, surprise, like people get quote unquote lucky. But I think there should be a different word for it, dude, because I don't think it's luck.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're sort of... Yeah, luck's not the right word. I mean, there's sort of kind of like a being in the right place at the right time thing. But again, that stems from just working your ass off and putting the time in. I mean, like the Patterson thing, it came about because I go to BoucherCon and I knew this editor at Little Brown and he was a good dude. And every now and again, we would like grab a cup of coffee or grab a drink. And I never thought I wasn't doing it because I thought he was eventually going to offer me something like this. I was just doing it because I was like, hey, he seems like a nice guy. We should hang out.
Right.
And then he was like, oh, by the way, this is a new thing we're doing. Are you interested? And so, you know, part of it was lucky that the timing worked out that I saw him when they were looking for authors. But it was also because I was, you know, making sure that I was out there and I had my feet on the ground.
Yeah. And I mean, and there's that, and like the idea that, you know, you create your own luck. And, you know, if that didn't come, excuse me, if that didn't come along, who's to say that four different things wouldn't have happened at similar points in your life? You know what I mean? Like, if you constantly are doing things, you'll constantly have opportunities coming down the pipeline, and then you just have to take them.
Yeah.
So, all right. Microsoft Word. That one's more like, bah, whatever. I mean, it makes sense, right? Like, use Microsoft Word for your submissions, people.
Yeah, man. I've got people who use Pages. I've got people who use OpenOffice, and something always gets fucked up. Something gets fucked up in layout. Something gets fucked up on track changes. Fucking Word, man. You just write it off on your taxes.
And don't get cute with it either. Like, just fucking write it. Like, no funny structural things. If you want funny structural things, let me know. I'll fix it in post. But don't try to do it in the fucking document.
Yep.
Let's see. There's a reason the publishing process takes a long time. There's a lot of work that goes into the process. It's not because anyone wants to see you suffer. Thank you. Amen. Would you like to explain?
So I had this author once who he was really pushing us, like, how quickly can you get this book out? Can you get it out as soon as possible? Can you get it out in 3 or 4 months? And I'm like, dude, we can do that, and we're going to put out an inferior product because we're not going to be able to do as much copy editing that needs to be done. You know, something's going to get fucked up in the process because there are checks that have to go in that aren't going to happen. You're not going to get any trade reviews because when you submit for trade reviews, you have to do that like a few more months than that in anticipation.
I know for Publishers Weekly, it's 3 months is the cutoff.
Yeah. But you still, the thing is if you get it in early and Publishers Weekly says something really nice about it, you have a blurb to put on the final copy of the book.
Right.
So there are, you know, a long lead time is good because it gives you more time to do the work that needs to be done. Because, you know, copy editing a book takes a long fucking time, you know, because you want it done right. Just like anything, you want anything done right. You want the time to be put into it. And so to rush through the process just means that mistakes are going to be made, that opportunities are going to be lost. Because, like, getting fucking reviews, man, that sucks. Like, it's really fucking hard. Because when you go to somebody for a review, like, you go to some newspaper and you're like, hey, I've got this really cool book for you to review, and you give them the book, they put it on the pile of 50 other books that they have.
Yep.
You know, like, you don't have this direct line to everyone. Like, you have to get in the queue. The earlier you get in the queue, the more of a chance there's going to be cool shit for you by the time you get to the front.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, you'd mentioned that LA Review of Books review. Zero Saints came out a year ago.
Yeah.
So it takes time.
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes those things come much further down the line and that's cool. But, you know, you can't rush the process. And I know that some people get all bent out of shape because they'll sign a contract and be like, well, my book's not coming out for 2 years. And it's like, that's maybe not such a bad thing because that means your publisher is putting in a lot of work to make sure that people try to buy it. I mean, they're not buying the book so that you can sit alone and be sad. They're buying the book because they believe in you and they think it can make money and that people will read it. So,
And I kind of just don't understand the sort of general rush to do any of this shit, you know? Like, why? I mean, I think this might be a little bit off the track here, but, you know, I've gotten a lot of stuff. No, it is totally off the beaten track. I was just thinking about people's like pathological, sad, thirsty need to be published in general, which is just kind of, it's kind of gross in a weird way, you know, that people, like, they want the book, they want it out now, they want to be a published author so bad. And it's just, I just feel like people should chill the fuck out, but...
Well, there's a degree to which I understand it. I mean, there is certainly a narcissistic aspect. Sorry, I'm getting over a cold and my throat's all fucked up.
That's cool.
There's a narcissistic aspect to it, but there's also, you know, you might spend like 3 years writing a book and then you get to the end and it's like, oh man, I have to wait even fucking longer. Like, it's a long fucking time and it sucks to wait for things. And that's part of the thing that sucks about the writing process is that every part of the writing process is very, very long. So eventually that just kind of builds up to the point where you kind of want to like slam your head into a wall.
Sure.
But you know, but you're right. There's also sort of a, dude, you have to chill the fuck out and understand that if we're going to do this, we're going to do this right.
Because my questions would be, number one, why did it take you 3 years to write this book? It's 40,000 words. And then I would say, if you wanted this book to be out in 3 months, you probably should have started writing it 3 years before you started writing it. And then you'd be right on time. There's just all this shit where it's like you can't bend the universe to your will, basically. Like, you have to put it like, yeah. I mean, I was talking to my buddy Brian, and he got a book with Soho, right?
Yeah.
And it's a rough fucking process, man. He said he's been through that book 40 times now, and it's still not going to come out for a year. And he sold it a year ago, you know? And he's like, man, this is fucking exhausting. But, I mean, it's part of the game.
Yeah.
I think it only gets worse once you get higher and higher up, too.
Because, oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah. I mean, small presses are pretty fucking quick compared to what you get at a Soho or one of the big five, basically.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I gave my fourth book to my publisher in like last month, and it's going to come out in July. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I was with a big five publisher, it would probably be coming out in like the beginning of 2018.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's just kind of the way it works. So everybody needs to get themselves a meditation app, sit down, you know, breathe some incense, whatever they want to breathe in, and just fucking take it easy. This is my favorite one, though. This one is my favorite. Nobody owes you anything. That's fucking brilliant. That's my high horse, not my high horse, but my, the drum that I've been beating.
Yeah.
Is nobody owes you anything. I don't owe you anything. Rob doesn't owe you anything. The world doesn't owe you anything at all.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the mass psychosis that I see on primarily on Facebook all the time. It's just this feeling that, like, you were talking about somebody earlier, and I'm going to talk about somebody who might be the same person, but I don't know.
Ooh.
Somebody who continually lashes out at their fans for not buying their book.
I was talking about someone different, but I know what you're talking about.
The only reason you know that it's somebody different is because you know exactly who I'm talking about.
Yep.
And that, to me, is the most mind-boggling thing you could possibly do.
Yeah.
I'm not sure entirely what that strategy is, but it does just kind of feel like, you know, you guys owe it to me. I spent the time writing this. You guys owe it to me to give me some kind of success.
Yeah.
And, yeah, no, I mean, I just don't get it. If you got rejected by a short fiction magazine you didn't bother to read to get a sense of their editorial voice, that's on you. I'm laughing because I can relate.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a... And this goes into the problem with the short fiction market. I mean, I think Todd Robinson was talking about this. You know, he did Thuglit for a while, and then he closed Thuglit because the sales were in the toilet, and he couldn't justify the time to do it anymore. And it's like he was like, you know, if as many people bought the fucking magazine as submitted to the magazine, you know, I'd be in much better shape.
Oh, Jesus, I can so fucking relate to that.
And that's insane to me because, you know, if you want to, you have to get a sense of the kind of stories they were going to publish. I mean, this again goes back to the idea of good is not good enough. Even if you write a really good story, the story just might not be the right fit for the editor who's reading it. You know, I mean, I've got this new white whale. My new white whale is Ellery Queen. Mm. I really want to get a story in Ellery Queen because I just think it would be cool. Mm. And I got rejected by them 3 times so far.
I think that makes you a fucking loser.
I know it does. you know, and one of the stories, they were actually really complimentary, and they were like, you know, we really like this. It's just not right for the magazine. And that's when I was like, you know what? That's because I haven't spent enough time reading the magazine. Mm-hmm. And so I'm reading it more, and I'm trying to get a better sense of the stories they're looking for so that I can, you know, get in there. And I think a lot of people, you know, again, they just get this. They build this narrative of like, well, you know, I write great stories and nobody wants them. And it's like, no, you're just not sending them to the right people. Mm-hmm. Or you're not sending them the stories that they want.
Right, right. Or, I mean, and it's just kind of a crapshoot. See, this is where I'm kind of getting a little bit curious because is what you're suggesting that there's a that there's a kind of formula to make this stuff work?
I wouldn't say a formula as much as, you have to know the audience that you're writing for. I mean, I'm not gonna, just like I wouldn't send Todd a romance story for Thuglet, I'm not gonna send like slash fic to Ellery Queen. I'm not gonna send a sci-fi story to, I don't know, I'm running out of examples. But, I'm gonna send this. I'm going to make sure that the stories that I'm writing are going to the people who I think might respond to them, not just, fucking carpet bomb and hope that I get lucky and get somebody with it.
I once got a children's coloring book submitted to Broken River.
Yeah, man. That's someone who I think might not have done a lot of research on Broken River.
No, yeah, I would I would
You
agree, yeah.
I've got on the Mysterious Press website, like we don't take unsolicited submissions, and I've got it like underlined and bolted and with stars next to it. I still get unsolicited submissions all the time. And for the most part, they are mystery books, but every now and again, it's something like, here's my romance novel. And I'm like,
The press is fucking
but
called Mysterious.
yeah, we don't even have anything on our list close to that. But, yeah, I mean, some people just don't care. They'll just send it to anyone, and then they get all indignant when, no one takes it. It's like, well, that's because you fucked up.
I had somebody, actually, it's been weird. I've had a recent onslaught of people who have been sending me messages that have said, I know that you are closed, but I figured I would send this to you anyway.
Would that ever work?
Oh, no. In fact, it does the exact opposite. Like, the door has shut for you permanently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Because to my mind, that shows such a lack of respect and foresight
Yeah.
and such a kind of sort of self-absorbed drive, basically, to just get published at all costs that I would hate to see what kind of fucking nightmare you were once the book came out.
Yeah.
It's just, it's. That's something that I think a lot of people don't understand too, is that for me at least, I went into this initially looking at does the book, do I love it? Does it fit the catalog? And that was it. However, life has bitch slapped me enough in the past year or so where now there's a third criteria. Are you chill?
Yeah.
And it actually matters to me, man. Like I've had to turn things down because I've seen people go off on other people on the internet, and I'm just like, I don't have fucking time to deal with that, you know?
Yeah.
So who you are and how you kind of conduct yourself in general, I think is something that people don't take into account very much because they think that, I'm an artist and I can act however I want. And it's like, well, yeah, no, but
Yeah, I mean,
I don't want to take you in fucking public that way.
yeah, I mean, Broken River is your fucking house party, and who you want in that party is who you want in that party. You're not going to just invite anyone in.
Even if you're really cool, it's like, hey, that guy's got really sweet moves, or hey, that guy's got a fucking 30 pack. It's like, yeah, but he also, he stole all my jewelry last time, and he goes through my drawer and puts my underwear on and stuff. So
Yeah.
he can't come in. I don't care how much beer he has.
Exactly.
But so shifting gears a little bit, I think that was a pretty informative talk. I think
Yeah.
the overall thrust of it was just don't be a dick and work on your craft. Work on your craft and don't be a dick.
That's all it really comes down to. Those are like the two big rules in publishing. That's all you need to know.
So you got this new one coming out. What's it called?
The Woman from Prague.
Okay, so, and this is the fourth one. So this is a series that you have going on here.
Yes, correct.
You want to just give a quick little pitch about that series?
Sure. It's about a private an amateur private detective named Ash McKenna, who starts out in New York in the first book, which is called New York, and each book sort of brings him through a different place. The second book, City of Rose, is set in Portland. The third book, South Village, is set in a hippie commune in the Georgia woods, and now this fourth one is set in Prague. So it's sort of like an origin story of a private detective, like this kid who will eventually be a private detective and how he's getting there. And so the fourth book I'm super excited about because they're bumping me up to hardcover.
Oh, fuck yeah, dude. That's
Yeah,
tight.
it's going to be a much more effective, you know, like paperweight and book stop, and it's going to have so many more uses.
Yeah, no shit. That's congratulations, man. That's a cool feeling.
Yeah, and it's just I'm really proud of the book, because the first three books are sort of like a spiritual trilogy, in the sense that the character is processing a lot of like grief and anger, and by the end of the third book, kind of gets to a point where he's okay with himself and his place in the world. So the fourth book is just fucking ridiculous. It's a spy novel, essentially, but it's like my take on a spy novel. So like every time he ends up in a situation where it's like, oh, I'll do this cool trick, it doesn't work, and he has to like kick someone in the nuts and throw them in a trunk or something. But it was fucking fun to write. It's a little over the top and a little silly, but I think it kind of works. So, you know, we'll see. I don't know. I mean, I sent it to my editor and I'm waiting to hear back from him, and he's either going to call me and be like, fuck you, dude, or yeah, okay, fine. So we'll find out.
Wait, with this new one, but it's already going to be a hardcover. So what are they going to do? Like,
I hope he likes it, because if he doesn't, we're going to have a lot of work to do, but
it's going to have to be like, bang something. I guess you just have to fucking write a whole nother novel in, you know, a month or so, which you seem to be fond of doing.
Oh God. I think that the bones are there. I mean, I don't think there's any major surgery coming. But I also try not to get too hopped up on that feeling of like, you know, yeah, I nailed this, because he always comes back to me with shit that it's like, fuck, I should have thought of that. That's embarrassing.
Got any good examples?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head. There's always stuff that he catches that it's like, oh yeah, this just doesn't make any sense. Actually, no. In the beginning of City of Rose, the one character threatens another character, and it's sort of like the inciting incident of the book. And he's like, why the fuck doesn't he just go to the cops? And I'm like, oh, that would have made a lot more sense, wouldn't it? I don't have a book now. So and you it's one of those things that I figured out a way to kind of work it in where essentially the one guy says like, and if you go to the cops, we'll kill you. We own the cops or something.
Yeah.
So there's always a fix, but yeah, it's shit like that where it's like, oh yeah, if he did this, because I really hate that. I hate the fucking idiot plot where, you know, when two characters could have a very simple conversation and it would completely negate everything that comes after it.
Dude, yeah.
And so I felt like a dick because I was like, here's the thing that I hate, and I fucking did it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, no, I think that that's totally true. That's why for a lot of my books, I have I start off with an idea for a crime, and then most of the book is actually a gradual buildup to that crime. It's very rarely at the beginning, because that's one of my most like fascinating things is that I'll say, oh, what if, you know, somebody was doing this, right? If they were, you know, putting poppy seeds in soda bottles and selling this kind of liquid heroin to people. And I'm more interested in like, how would they get to the point that they do that, right?
Yeah.
And so the thing that comes up in so many of these books is, why doesn't anybody call the cops, right? Movies too. It's like, why didn't they call the cops? Why aren't they calling the cops? Just call the cops. But I think that there's a lot of good workarounds, but also something that kind of throws a monkey wrench into that even is that when you read true crime stories, you read them and you're like, why didn't anybody call the cops? You know what I mean? Like, why have they not done this yet? So I see where you're coming from, and I'm totally 100% on board, even in my own writing, because it's like a pet peeve of mine that I can't move forward until I figure that out. But on the other hand, in real life, people can be pretty fucking stupid.
They can be. Yeah. I mean, people make really dumb decisions. And the other part of it too is like, Ash is very much a product of like post 9/11 New York, when the New York City Police Department became basically like a militarized force.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and outside of the much larger conversation of, you know, police officers shooting people and then not going to jail for it, in New York, there's a very specific feeling of being afraid of the police, that the police are going to fuck you. So
last I heard, they were the eighth largest standing army in the world.
Sounds about right.
The NYPD. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's still, man, I mean, you know, you kind of get used to it, but every now and again, it fucking throws me where I'm like walking through Times Square and there'll be like 20 guys standing there with fucking assault rifles. And I'm like, this just doesn't feel good.
Dude,
I don't like seeing this.
After the Paris attacks, I went to Paris, and, there were in the Paris airports, it was exactly that. It was like dudes in ski masks with assault rifles.
And yeah.
It's like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Like I take the Staten Island Ferry home, and every now and again, like I'll be sitting there reading and look out the window, and there'll be like a Coast Guard boat with a big like fucking 50 caliber machine gun on the front of it, and I'm like, cool.
It's like,
I live in
why?
a fucking video game.
Why? Is that like, well, when, I think two times ago when I was in New York, I was trying to get down to the train, and the turnstile was broken, and it was one of those like those big full body turnstiles. What do you call those things? Is
Oh,
it
I don't know what they're called. They're just, yeah, they're like the big ones, like they're kind of like the revolving doors with the bars.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like my card wasn't working. Like it had money on it, my subway pass or whatever. It wasn't working, and so my brother just like opened the outdoor and like let me in.
Yeah.
And like we went around the corner, and there was literally like two cops just watching for people to do that exact thing. And I'm
Yeah.
like, you knew you had a little busted thing, right? That only works every fourth time. And they were literally just getting done giving a ticket to somebody else, and they were like, just kind of waved me over. And I was
Yep.
like, Jesus Christ, these fucking assholes.
Yep, it is a it's a great way to raise revenue for the city budget. Just write fucking tickets.
So are you from New York originally?
Yeah, born and raised.
In what part?
Staten Island.
So do you don't seem to have much of an accent. Is that is what you have a Staten Island accent?
I don't know. I've heard so many varying things from people. I hear from a lot of people that I don't have an accent. I've had people say, "Oh yeah, you're obviously from New York." When I was in London, everyone thought I was Canadian, but I think that's just because I'm generally polite. And then I once
Except oddly
met,
enough, two Canadians.
yeah, seriously. But then I once met someone who I and she was like, "Where are you from?" And then put her finger up. She's like, "Wait, no, Staten Island." And I'm like, "How the fuck did you do that?"
Wow. So it's there.
I guess I don't know what she heard, but yeah, I don't know.
Well,
I don't
because
know.
you know, like when you talk to like Scott Adlerberg, it's like, oh,
Oh yeah.
I know where you're from. Or
Oh yeah.
Todd. You
Yeah.
know, you can hear the Boston and Todd's accent, like.
You can hear the Boston and the New York, but it's the funny thing about Todd is that when he we went to we've gone to Boston twice, and both times the Boston accent starts coming out.
Oh,
And it's
really?
so fucking weird and kind of off-putting because like we'll just be talking and suddenly he's like talking with a different accent. I'm like, "Why are you doing this?
Yeah, well, it's
Fucking weirdo."
besides that, the Boston accent is by far the most horrific American accent of all of the accents.
It really is because you sound like you got hit in the head with a brick.
You kind of do. I mean, I'm normally the go-to for like kind of making fun of people is like the South, and there are some pretty horrendous accents, especially once you get down to like Georgia and Louisiana and places like
Yeah.
that. But there's also a lot of really pretty accents down there too. But Boston is just fucking, just it's rough, man. It's
It
really
is.
rough. I think I
Well,
was.
so you're from Oklahoma, right? Originally?
That is correct. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really seem to have much of an accent either.
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting because I don't think very many people in Oklahoma do have accents. They have like little things, I guess, that I will sometimes say, like whenever people say thank you instead of you're welcome, it's you bet, you know.
Okay.
I mean, it's just a bunch of little things. And I mean, yeah, sure, there are people who have really kind of pronounced Oklahoma accents, but that's more like down in Texas. Oklahoma is very much a melting pot, I think, of
Yeah.
different accents and places. But you know, when you go to California, you can hear it. And then
Yeah.
even people here in Portland, I think, have specific accents. The further north you get, like the voices just change. It's very bizarre.
I've never really picked up on much of an accent in Portland, but I guess a lot of the people I know in Portland aren't from Portland.
It's like a very light, almost Minnesota thing. It's like Minnesota way watered down.
Okay.
Like you can barely hear it. It's mostly just, you know, straightforward middle of the road English, but then, you know, you'll have little things like instead of no, it'll be just like no, you know, like
Yeah.
just very subtle changes in that. But what the hell are we talking about? New
I don't fuck.
York?
Man, sure. Fuck this place.
Wait, do you like living there? I mean, like, are you trying to get out? Are you
No, I
chill?
mean we're pretty much set here because between my job and her job, my wife works for a museum, and we have a baby, and both of our families live within walking distance of us. So we have like free daycare whenever we need it. Like if we want to go out sometime and see a movie or something, which we rarely do anyway, but if we need to, it's like fucking Thunderdome between our moms, where like they keep a running track record of who had the baby last. So whose turn it is.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. God, we are so lucky. It's insane. But, I thought about leaving New York at one point. Me and my wife were thinking about moving to like Austin or Portland or something. And that's actually part of what writing New York was about. It was about me kind of working my feelings out about living here, because it's a great city, man, and it's fun, but it'll fucking wear on you. And I got to a point where I was like, I think I'm done with it. And when two things happened. I finished the book and I was like, no, I really don't think I could live anywhere else. I think this is where I need to be. Mm-hmm. And as we were telling our families that we were kind of thinking about moving to another city, my wife's family was like, hey, you know, we have this house that we've been renting out for years and years and years. And, you know, why don't you just take that? And we were like, huh?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an old house and we're still doing a lot of work on it, but it's a nice little house. Mm-hmm. So
whenever I think of Staten Island, I think of the episode of MTV Cribs with, who was it? It was Redman. Redman lived out on Staten Island.
Yeah.
He had this screen door that was broken and you had to fucking click the wires together to ring the doorbell. And he had all of his money he kept in a shoebox on top of his fridge. And he had just his fucking cousin on a sleeping bag in the floor. So that's my kind of image of Staten Island. I don't know how accurate that is.
I don't know. You know what? Maybe I'll take you around here when you come out. I think everyone has some kind of like Wu-Tang story. I was telling someone this story earlier in the night, because they were like, oh, you know, you're from Staten Island, you know, the Wu-Tang Clan. And I'm like, that's a question. But actually, I used to work, you know, the hat store Lids.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's one in the Staten Island Mall and I worked there when I was in high school, and Method Man would come in every now and again. And you could always tell he was coming because one, he's a tall dude. And two, there'd be like, you know, like 20 white kids, like little kids, like following him, like 100 feet behind him.
Right.
And he would come in and he would spend like $200 on hats. And it was awesome because I would hit my numbers for the month in like that one transaction.
Oh, it's fucking
cool. And be like, dude, thank you so much. And he was a nice guy and he came in and he bought his hats and he left. And so, yeah, you know, that was my brush with fame.
That's pretty cool. I'm trying to think. There was in Oklahoma, we would just get you see Wayne Coyne a lot from the Flaming Lips.
Yeah,
and he's just kind of a fucking weirdo, dopey guy.
There's also which I think is super fucking cool. David Johansen from the New York Dolls lives on Staten Island. He actually lives in my neighborhood, and I see him every now and again. And I was in the Apple Store picking something up, and he walked in sweatpants, and I'm like, "Punk is dead."
Were they Victoria's Secret with like Juicy across the butt?
They were not. Sadly,
that would be kind of punk, though.
But then I also like he did like a super cool acoustic show at a local theater like a year ago that I went to that was like really fucking awesome. So that was a fun thing.
Well, that's what's so cool about New York. And I think I feel like probably after the 2 weeks I'm there, I'll be burnt out, because what I've learned from living even in Portland is that I'm not a big city dude. And I think it's from growing up in a place where there's wide open spaces and not a lot of people, you know? So, I think it would just kind of drive me crazy. But the flip side of that is that there's always shit to do. Like like nobody, people in New York don't know what it means to be bored. Basically, there's no way you could be bored and live in New York City.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds fair. I can't even dispute that. I mean, you know, my days of like going out until fucking 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning and making really poor decisions is pretty much over.
Were you a party guy? Like a big time party guy?
Not a party guy. I was a big bar guy.
Okay.
So I, for the longest time, after I graduated college, I had a couple of female friends who lived in an apartment in Harlem, up on 139 and Broad. And so I would finish work on Fridays and I would go to their apartment, and they had this girl who lived with them who was never there. She just had the apartment, and I guess she had money or something, because
Trust
like,
fund kid.
yeah, and it was an empty bedroom, and so it basically turned into my bedroom, which I don't think she ever found out, which was fucking cool. So she basically was like subsidizing me to like live in Harlem on the weekends.
It's like I drooled all over your shit,
Oh
basically.
yeah.
Yeah.
And so we would watch shitty movies during the day and like eat shitty food from the bodega, and then we would go down to the bars and we would party until like 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, and then we would go back and crash the fuck out and wake up around like 4 o'clock and then do it again on Saturday night.
That's the life, man.
Yeah, it was a fun period.
I can't do that anymore. I find that I could do it in concentrated bursts, like for cons and stuff. I can, you
Yeah,
know.
I kind of save it up for cons at this point, because I
Yeah.
mean the baby is on such a regular sleep schedule. I mean, she goes down at 8 and she wakes up at about 7.
Oh,
So I know that I'm waking up at 7, and my wife likes to sleep in, so a lot of the times I'll wake up with the baby. And so like my entire like I used to be such a night person, and now it's like I hit like 11 o'clock and I start getting fucking whiny and cranky and I want to go to sleep.
Speaking of which, it's about 10:30. I think this has been fucking great, man.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on, dude. We should do it again sometime.
Yeah, thanks for having me.